of her head, but when she did, the pain shot through her, and she jerked her arms back down and leaned forward to groan. "You got some busted ribs," the medic said. "You need to get into town, go to the hospital."
"Gotta go find my friend," Liddy said.
The second nose pad was now soaked with blood, and the medic gave her a whole pack of them.
"Keep pressing them against the side of your nose."
"Gotta find my friend."
"Dave and me'll give you a ride down there," the fat man said. "And my name is Randy. I'm your friendly fat guy."
When Letty was taken out of Pilot's circle, a number of juggalos stood around looking at them, and one of them, maybe drunk, asked,
"What did you hit the chick for, asshole?"
"Caught her fucking around on me,"
Pilot improvised. He turned away. No place to get in a real fight, not with juggalos. They'd swarm you. And he said to Kristen,
"Keep moving. We gotta get out of here. Too many people here. The cops could be coming."
They started moving, and Belle slipped off into the stand of trees where they'd left Sky, half buried in brush. He gathered up as many downed tree limbs as he could easily find, threw them on top of her, broke a few more off the evergreens, and added those. When he was done, he thought Skye's grave looked like an ordinary pile of brush. Somebody might find her eventually, but not until they were long gone. He hurried back to the circle, where they were throwing stuff in his car. Pilot pulled Raleigh aside. Raleigh was in full juggalo dress.
"You got Colorado license plates, so nobody will be looking at you. I want you to hang out here, see what happens. Stay all the way to the end. Anything too weird happens, call me."
"Got it,"
Pilot said.
"You can have Linda to ride with you."
Raleigh gave him a thumbs up.
"Most excellent. I will pound her like a fucking big bass drum."
Pilot patted him on the cheek, then pulled the others together for one last-minute pep talk.
"This isn't working out as well as we thought.
That fucking Sky might have fucked us up. We don't know what she told the cops after Boney got killed. Let's meet up next week at the gathering in Sault Ste. Marie. Kristen's dividing up the money, giving some to everybody. Save as much as you can. We can't go in a convoy because Sky probably told them that's how we travel, and that we're from California and we've all got California plates. So when we head out, split up. Everybody go their own way. Go to town and get maps and, you know, stay out of sight. See you at the gathering next week. Remember, we rule."
Everybody muttered,
"We rule."
And a minute later, Pilot rolled out in his Pontiac, followed by the RV, and then the others. The fat man and his driver took Letty to where Pilot had been, but when they got back behind the stage, the circle of cars was gone. She unconsciously grabbed the hair above her ears and squeezed her fingers tight.
"Oh my God, I let them go."
She stood up in the back of the cart, turned and looked down the length of the parking area, hoping to catch sight of the convoy before it got out to the highway. If she could get a tag number, any tag number. She saw taillights of cars turning onto the highway, but they were too far away to read any tag numbers, and even if she had been able to see them, she couldn't be sure they were the right cars. She got on the phone, and Lucas answered instantly.
"Dad, I found them, Pilot, and then I lost them. I think they're on the road."
"Are they in one tight convoy?"
"I don't know. There are all kinds of cars coming and going," she said.
"You okay?"
"Not exactly," she said,
pressing the gauze pad to her nose. Lucas got there 15 minutes later, along with 3 sheriff's cars and 6 deputies, all in plain clothes. Letty was waiting at the entrance to the parking lot, and when he got out of his car, Lucas said,
"Aw, Jesus Christ, Letty."
He reached for her to hug her, but she flinched away and said,
"Don't do that. I might have cracked a rib or something.
Pilot kicked me. It hurts.
Need to get you to the hospital. Need to get you going."
Lucas looked frightened, something she really hadn't seen before. Frantic, yes. Frightened, no. Letty said, I'm not gonna die. I just don't want to be squeezed. Let me see your face. After they did all the father-daughter stuff, Letty told Lucas and the ring of cops, they were parked right here. She told her story about the disappearance of Sky and the attack by Pilot, and how the man in the John Deere saved her, and how just before they left, Pilot and his disciples had been in the trees across the entry road. She pointed past the parking area to the scraggly stand of pine and aspen, and they did a little dance, jumping up and down. By the end of the story, she was shouting at them. The music had stepped up another notch, now as loud as a jet plane at takeoff, loud enough to feel it scratching at your face. The group on stage had set off whirling green laser lights that flashed up into the trees around the field and made the branches seem to sparkle with thousands of emeralds. Lucas took a moment to walk away to the fat man in the John Deere and say something to him, and then slap him on the back and say something else, and then he walked back to Letty and the deputies and said, I'll talk to that guy again. Now, where were they parked exactly? And you say there was another RV? Before she could answer, he said to one of the deputies, And I need one of you guys to run Letty into the clinic.
Not yet, not yet, Letty protested. In a minute.
Yet, Lucas said. There was a copper taste in the back of his mouth, like blood. Letty was still bleeding from her nose and would have a major black eye. He could see it already.
In a minute, she said again.
Another cop car had come in, and a seventh deputy joined them, this one in a uniform. They all had flashlights, and they walked across the circular parking area inch by inch and dumped out a plastic trash bin that sat at the edge of the parking lot, 30 or 40 yards away, checking the contents under the flashlights. As the deputies were doing that, Lucas scuffed around the fire, his own flashlight probing the dirt, looking for something, anything, a charge slip would be good, something with a credit card number, that might tell them something about Pilot's group, and at the same time, lecturing Letty. God damn it, Letty, I know you're grown up and all of that. Letty pointed to the clump of trees. I'm going over there, where they were dancing. You're going back to town. In a minute. He followed her and rolled on through the lecture as they got into the trees. Nothing there but a pile of brush and some scuffed-up dirt. The strobe from the stage was flickering off the tree branches and aspen leaves and made it hard to focus on anything. Lucas walked back until the brush got dense enough to drag at his jeans, then shone his light deeper into the trees, saw nothing interesting, and walked back toward Letty. To get to her, he had to circle the edge of the pile of tree limbs and caught a flash of yellow-white. The stump end of one of the tree limbs was fresh, recently ripped off a tree. He stopped and shone the light into the pile and saw more fresh breaks. Letty asked, What? These branches. Looks like somebody just broke them off the trees. He shone the flash around the clump of evergreens and spotted a couple of places where the limbs had been pulled off, leaving a white gash in the bark. They moved the smaller branches, and Letty, one arm clutched to her injured side, tugged away a bigger one. As she dragged it out, she spotted a streak of deep pumpkin orange in the light of the flash. Her hands went to her mouth, and she said, Oh, no. No. What?
Sky bought some orange socks at REI. We joked about it.
Lucas shone the light deeper into the pile, caught the flash of orange. Okay, get back. Get out of the trees. Letty backed away, and Lucas shouted at the deputies, who hurried over. Lucas said, We might have something here. We don't want to move any more stuff than we have to, if it turns out to be a crime scene. But there's an orange something under these tree limbs. Might be a sock. Somebody hold the light. They spotted the streak of orange again, and two of the deputies lit it up from different sides, and then the third deputy held Lucas's belt at the back
so he could lean far into the pile without touching anything, and he pushed aside some bark and pine needles and said, "It's a foot. There's a body under here."
"We gotta get her out," Letty cried. "It hasn't been long. She could still be alive."
"Don't think so," Lucas said. "Can't take the chance. Let's see if we can spot how she's oriented under there." They pulled out a few more tree limbs, discovered a lower arm, and Letty, standing next to Lucas, with both hands now clutching her chest, saw the plastic exercise brace that she'd given Sky in San Francisco.
"Oh my God, it's her, it's her, it's her."
She was babbling and knew it, but couldn't stop. One of the deputies put an arm over her chest and pulled her away. Lucas decided where Skye's head must be. The body was hardly buried, mostly just covered with damp leaves, pine needles, and brush. When Lucas found Skye's face, the first thing he saw was one dead blue eye, nearly popped from its socket behind a crushed zygomatic bone. When he saw it and the graying flesh behind it, the anger finally ripped through him. It had been a year since he'd felt anything like it, since the fight in a madman's basement. Letty's actions had frightened him, but he'd always known through the series of phone calls that she was all right. But Sky, a young woman who had no parent or anyone else to look after her except his daughter, and this could have happened to Letty if a fat man hadn't been there. If they'd dragged her off between the cars... For a whole year, he'd been stuck in bureaucratic mode, running down little ratchet criminals. Even in the larger cases, like the Marion murder case, the trial would turn on sleazy, money-conflicted witnesses. This was different. This was a kid. He backed away. She's gone. She's gone, goddammit. "We need to get a crime scene crew out here." Jesus Christ, she's gone. He wrapped an arm around Letty, and one of the deputies went running to his car to call more cops. In the background, the rap went on, and the strobe bounced its wicked multicolored light off all the clown faces around them. Letty started to cry into Lucas's shoulder. 9. Lucas told the deputies that he had to take Letty to the hospital, right now, and he pried Letty loose from the murder scene and half-dragged her across the parking lot to where she'd parked the SUV. The only thing Letty said on the way out of the parking lot was, "Take it slow." Her nose was bleeding again, and she tipped her head and pushed Kleenex into her nostril. "What was I thinking about?" Lucas asked, pounding the steering wheel as they headed out the highway toward town. "What the fuck was I thinking about?" He had his flashes on, but the highway was crowded with people heading into the Juggalo gathering or leaving it, and he never got any speed. "You should have been at the goddamn hospital a half hour ago," he groaned. "What the fuck was I thinking about?"
"Had to find Sky."
"Somebody else could have found her," Lucas said. He turned sideways. "Tell me the truth. How bad?"
"It hurts, but he never hit me or kicked me square except that first punch, and that didn't knock me out or anything. I kept moving."
"Get the fuck out of the way, you asshole!" Lucas shouted at a slow-moving car ahead of them. "Get the fuck out of the way!" He crowded the car until it pulled off onto the shoulder, then accelerated away until he caught the next slow-moving vehicle. "He could have killed you if that fat guy hadn't helped you," Lucas said. "Letty, you're not a cop. Maybe you will be, but you're not now. What you did..." He trailed off, and she said, "Stupid." Lucas banged the steering wheel with the heels of his hands. "Motherfuckers, get out of the fucking way!" As they got close to Hayward, Letty said, "You're mad now?" "Yes," Lucas said. "I don't want to sound like a jerk, but I don't think the sheriff's deputies up here will find Pilot.
They don't do that kind of thing. They don't track people. They've got their county, and that's it.
Lucas nodded. She was right.
So you're gonna have to do it.
He didn't have an answer to that.
They crossed Highway 63 and pulled into the hospital emergency room, and Lucas let her in. A nurse went to wake up the night doc, and a couple minutes later he came in and took Letty away while Lucas went to fill out some paperwork.
The doc was back in 5 minutes and said, "We're going to do some x-rays. She got hit hard by that eye. I want to make sure nothing's broken, and I want to take a look at her ribs. I think she's probably got a cracked rib or two. We need to make sure there's nothing sticking into a lung."
"What are the chances of that?"
The doc shook his head. "Small. The x-ray's more of a precaution than anything. We'll know right away if there's a problem."
Half an hour later, Letty was back. The doc was with her and said, "She's got 2 cracked ribs, but they're not displaced at all. Judging from the placement of the bruise where she was kicked, I don't think there'll be any complications. It was well away from the kidneys or liver. We already talked about it. She knows what to do and what to look out for. And there's not much to do except try not to sneeze or cough or laugh too hard."
"What about her face, her nose?" Lucas asked.
"Nothing broken, but she's got a small natural bone spur inside the nasal vault."
The doc tapped the bony top of his own nose to show Lucas what he was talking about.
"When she got hit, the spur apparently cut through a part of her nose lining, and that's where the blood is coming from. It didn't look like it was going to stop, so I put a little dab of chemical cautery up there to seal it up. It won't bleed any more, but it's going to hurt when the anesthetic wears off. I got her some pills for pain, more for the nose than the ribs."
"How long to heal up?" Lucas asked.
"Maybe 3 days for the nose to stop hurting. The ribs are going to hurt for a while. She's got a big bruise on her rib cage, and that'll add some pain in addition to the ribs, and she'll have a heck of a shiner. She's gonna be creaky in the morning. Nothing dangerous, but it's gonna hurt."
He looked at Letty and said, "Remember what I told you about, the side effects?"
"What side effects?" Lucas asked.
"Side effects of the drugs," the doc said.
Out in the truck, Lucas asked,
"What side effects?" The doc was tap dancing back there.
"He was afraid he'd embarrass me," Letty said. "If I use the pain pills, I might not be able to poop. He said I should get something called a stool softener."
"Does that embarrass you?"
"No."
"Good. If you get to be a cop and things get rough, they stick tubes into all kinds of places that could be embarrassing if you're the embarrassing type."
"I've had a few of them," Lucas said. "And?"
"I'm gonna call your mom."
"She's gonna scream," Letty said.
"Yeah, well, it's her turn."
Lucas called Weather, then gave his phone to Letty, who talked to her mother for another 5 minutes, telling her the whole story, downplaying her injuries. A cop car with flashing red lights whipped past them as they drove back toward the Juggalo campground. When Letty was finished talking, Lucas took the phone back and said,
"She's hurt more than she told you. She's not feeling too bad right now, but she will in the morning. She's not going to be driving anywhere. We're going to need somebody to come up here and get the truck or the Porsche."
Weather said that Letty should stay at the cabin until the next afternoon. Then she'd be up with either Lucas's old friend Sloan or with Dell's wife to get the extra car. A minute after he rang off, Lucas took a call from Stern.
"Clark Chapman called. He said you've got a body,"
Stern said. Chapman was the county sheriff.
"Yeah, Sky. Pilot apparently killed her by kicking her to death. My daughter might actually have witnessed the murder. She didn't know it at the time, only found out later."
"Jesus, is Letty okay?"
"More or less. Got beat up," Lucas said. He described the scene and how Letty was assaulted by Pilot.
"Oh, boy. Okay, we're blocking off all the major roads around there, making people go through the checkpoints.
I understand we're looking for a guy dressed as a priest.
Might not be anymore, Lucas said. After they killed Sky, they left in a hurry. They're running.
I'm rolling the crime scene crew, Stern said.
But, what are you doing up there?
Letty came up after Sky, and I got worried, Lucas said. I'm sort of up here as her dad. I'm gonna stand back now and let the deputies do it.
Don't stand too far back, Stern said. They might need a little advice.
Weren't you technically a deputy sheriff up there once? Seems like I remember something like that.
Yeah, but that was years ago, a different county, and it was pretty technical. Didn't get paid or anything.
Okay, but hang around for a while. I'm still in Madison. Talk them through it until I can get up there.
Lucas said he would. They came up to the gathering site, and Lucas asked Letty, "How bad do you hurt right now?"
"Not terrible.
I need to pull in here for a minute, kick the seat back, and sit here. Don't get out."
"'Kay."
Lucas parked and said again, "Do not get out." The deputies had taped off the area of the murder and Pilot's encampment and were waiting for the crime scene crew. Lucas had one of the plainclothes deputies interrupt the rap concert. The deputy went on stage and told the crowd that a Juggalo woman had been murdered by some outsiders from California, and that if anyone had taken any photos that showed a circle of cars parked over there, he pointed, "We would be desperately anxious to see them." The announcement cast a temporary pall over the concert. The pall lasted for more than 20 minutes before the music got back to where it had been, and a half dozen Juggalos wandered over to the cops to show off cell phone photos. One of them, by a Hayward Juggalo named Betty Morrow, had a snapshot that showed her girlfriend in the foreground and a license tag in the background on a car that appeared to be in the Pilot's circle. They couldn't make out the tag on the phone screen, but a deputy had Morrow email the photo to a friend of his in Hayward, an amateur wildlife photographer who ran the shot through Lightroom and 2 minutes later came back with both the license plate number and a make and model on the car, an aging Subaru Forester.
"Here's the thing. The plate's not from California," the deputy said. "I'll give you one guess where it's from."
"I don't want to guess," Lucas said. "Where's it from?"
"Would you believe Minnesota?"
"God damn it, they're from California," Lucas said. "If it's a Minnesota guy, he might not be related."
"He was parked in the circle," the deputy said.
"Give me the number. I'll call the office and have them run it," Lucas said. Lucas called the BCA duty officer in St. Paul and said, "Everything you've got, email it to me." The duty officer could give him one bit immediately. The car was registered to a Chester Tillis who lived east of Burdett in Lake of the Woods County.
"I'll get you a driver's license photo in 10 minutes if he's got one."
"Hang on." Lucas got an email address for the sheriff's office from the deputy and passed it on to the duty officer. "Send copies of everything to both me and the sheriff's office. They're looking for the guy over here in Wisconsin. Could be a murder charge involved."
"I'll do that. Are you at the scene?"
"Yeah, but I'm going over to my cabin," Lucas said. "Right now it's a snake hunt and the cheeseheads got it." The deputy said to Lucas when he rang off,
"Nothing I like better than a nice brie."
"I believe it," Lucas said. He called Stern to fill him in and said, "I can't think of anything else. I'm gonna get Letty back to my cabin and get some sleep myself."
"See you in the morning," Stern said. "I'm catching an early plane out."
Lucas drove out to his cabin, lit it up, offered to put together a cheeseburger, but Letty declined and said,
"I'm gonna go sit on the dock for a few minutes."
"You're sure?"
"Yep."
When Lucas followed her out, carrying a beer and his iPad, she'd unfolded a second deck chair for him. He sat down and sighed and said, "You do have the ability to piss me off from time to time."
"I know,"
she said. I don't think I can be any other way. Or you, either.
Probably not, he said.
You know how she was killed?
We'll know in the morning when crime scene gets a look, Lucas said. From what you saw and what I saw, I believe she was probably kicked to death.
Ah, jeez.
She was quiet for 10 seconds, then said,
I've been sitting here wondering if me meeting her had anything to do with her getting killed. The closest I can get is if I hadn't given her my phone number in San Francisco, she might never have found out that Henry was dead. Or she might have stayed in South Dakota looking for him, and she never would have run into Pilot at all. You follow all the breadcrumbs through the woods, that's what comes out.
That's a good way to drive yourself crazy, Lucas said.
I talked to Bob Schaffer before he went off and got murdered last year. We could have done 20 other things that day, and he'd still be alive. I believe there was 1 second, one tiny moment, that decided whether he'd live or die. If he hadn't gone into a supermarket for a jelly donut, he'd have lived. He was a pretty good husband and father, and he still would be. Yeah, but if he'd lived, you wouldn't have been so involved, and maybe Katrin Mattson would have died.
I don't know. She might have, or maybe Schaffer might have found her sooner, Lucas said. Impossible to know. The thing is, you take a fork in the road, it doesn't always work out for the better. But sometimes it does. It must. They were quiet for a couple of minutes, then Letty asked,
You get the email yet? From the office?
Let me check. He turned on the iPad and checked his mail. The download was slow, with only 2 bars on phone reception, but in 5 minutes he had a long file on Chester Tillis. Lucas scanned it and said, He's with them, with Pilot. He got on his cell and called the sheriff's office, talked to the duty sergeant, and told him the same thing. You find him, hold him, because he's part of the bunch. He's got 2 burglary convictions and 2 assault convictions in Minnesota, and a fighting charge in California, and that was only 2 months ago. He's been out there. He just didn't buy the California plates.
We're looking for him, the deputy said.
As Lucas and Letty sat talking on the dock, Pilot was on a back highway crossing into Michigan. The rest of the crew had scattered. Sky had been with the cops for a full day before the disciples killed her, and they had no idea what she might have told them. But she knew some names, for sure. After kicking her to death, they'd gotten scared. Pilot pretended he wasn't, but he was. All the other murders had been in quiet spots, with nobody around but the disciples. This time, they'd killed the woman next to a large crowd. Then the dark-haired juggalo chick had shown up and started yelling at him about Sky. Pilot had punched her, couldn't help himself. Chicks did not get up in his face like that and walk away. He was lucky in a way that the fat guy had shown up, because he was so buzzed on kicking the first girl to death that he might have killed the second one right there in front of the crowd. But the fat guy did show up, and the juggalo chick was taken away, and they'd hauled ass. With everybody else going every which way, Pilot headed east in his Firebird, followed by only one other vehicle, the new RV, driven by Terry and Lane. They stuck to back roads, but hurried to get across a state line. In Pilot's experience, which mostly came down to watching cops on television, the police did not talk well across state lines. Once in Michigan, at midnight, they found almost nothing. Trees.
Jesus, it's dark. Aren't even any cars, Kristen said, peering into the darkness through the Firebird's windshield. It's like somebody's pulled a black sack over your head.
Dark as the L.A. people had ever seen the world, even the car's headlights didn't seem to punch much of a hole in it.
A few miles into Michigan, they saw a narrow dirt track in their headlights heading off to the left with a sign and an arrow that said something that they were going too fast to read. They took the turn and found that it led to a boat landing. They couldn't see anything of the lake, but there were no lights anywhere. They got flashlights, found a spot where people had camped out, and rolled the two vehicles back into the trees.
"Now what?"
Lane asked when Pilot and Kristen joined Terry and her in the RV.
"Just gonna sit and wait," Pilot said.
Lane peered out a window.
"Bears out there, I bet. Maybe wolves."
"Wolves don't eat trucks," Pilot said. "It is really fucking dark, ain't it? Lots of stars, though."
Letty was hurting when she got up in the morning at 9 o'clock. Everything hurts. The nose hurts worst. Not the bruise, the place where the doctor cauterized it.
"Take some pills," Lucas said.
"I've already taken 4 of them," Letty said. "The max is 2.
"Uh-oh," Lucas said. "You're gonna have to stop at the drugstore."
"I always thought stool softener was for old people," she said. "Maybe you could get it for me."
"Screw that," Lucas said. "I'm not doing it."
A few minutes later, she said, "The nose, it really hurts. It feels like somebody stuck a blowtorch up there." Neither one of them felt like eating more Cheerios, left over from Lucas's first night at the cabin, so they drove back to the Juggalo gathering site, which had sprung 100 tents, and more people sleeping in cars, and, on one side, a big no-go sign defined by yellow crime scene tape and a bunch of sheriff's patrol cars and a Wisconsin crime scene truck. A group of Juggalos was disassembling the stage, and when Lucas asked, a deputy said they were going to move the stage to the other end of the field where the bonfire had been. The crime scene crew had exposed Skye's body. Her head was misshapen, like a partly deflated soccer ball. The leader of the crime scene crew said he'd heard that Lucas thought she'd been kicked to death, and he said,
"I think you're probably right. Doesn't look like clubs, no bark or anything in her face or her arms. Skull was crushed, with impact marks everywhere. Dollars to donuts, they kicked her to death.
DNA.
We're sampling everything that looks possible."
The deputies said that there'd been no convoys spotted overnight, but they did have tag numbers for a half dozen vehicles from California, which had been run when the cars were stopped. None of the people stopped were wearing Juggalo makeup. Nothing had come back that would allow the Wisconsin cops to hold the cars. The deputy said,
"What are we gonna do?"
"We got nothing to go on but that one tag from Minnesota, and we never did spot him."
Lucas said, "Give me what you got. All the California tags you stopped."
Both Lucas and Letty had to go into Hayward to make formal statements for the sheriff's department, so they continued into town. The guy who would take their statements wasn't in yet, and wasn't expected for half an hour, so they walked over to Main Street looking for breakfast. The Angler's Bar and Grill, where Lucas usually ate, wasn't open, so they settled for coffee and scones from a coffee shop around the block. Then they weren't far from Walgreens, so they walked across the highway, and Lucas lingered by the book rack as Letty was checking out with the stool softener. Outside, Lucas asked, "You got it?"
"Yeah, I told the checkout lady that it was for you, but you were embarrassed to ask for it."
Made him laugh. As they walked back toward the sheriff's office, they talked about the murder. Letty told Lucas, "Skye was going to stop at 3 Juggalo gatherings, one here, one in the UP, and one down by Detroit somewhere. She thought Pilot might be going to them, too. All the people I saw with Pilot were wearing Juggalo gear, like they were really into it."
"Where is it at, and when? The next meeting?"
"Let me look at my phone." A half block farther along, she said, "It's in Sault Ste. Marie, the American one. Actually on a farm south of the town. It's next weekend, and the Detroit one is 2 weeks from now."
Sault Ste. Marie is a hell of a long way from here, Lucas said. I drove it once years ago on my way to New York. If I remember, it's a 6 or 7 hour drive from here, 8 hours or more from the cities. You think you might go? Lucas scratched his cheek where a mosquito had bitten the night before, then said, I don't know. Maybe if these guys haven't turned up by then. The fastest way to get out of this area would be to go south. Once you get down to I-94, you could head down to Chicago or start back toward California. They'd have a whole choice of routes. If they drove all night after killing Sky, switching off drivers, they could be through Omaha, through Kansas City, down to Chicago. Unknown California license tags would be meaningless in the big cities. Tomorrow morning they could be damn near to Phoenix or Vegas or out to New York. We'll put out watches, but our best chance of finding them would be when they go back to L.A. The California cops are really hot for Pilot. So they're gone, as far as we're concerned, Letty said. They might be. But if they went south, they'd be in Wisconsin for a long time, where everybody was looking for them and not finding them. So they might have headed for the nearest state lines, back to Minnesota or east to Michigan. Depends on what this Pilot guy wants to do, I guess. If he's really a juggalo freak, he could show up in Sault Ste. Marie next week and then Detroit. I'll tell you something. You could hide a jumbo jet in the UP so nobody could find it. There's not a lot up there. If I were them, that's where I would have gone.
What are we gonna do? Letty asked.
What are we gonna do? I've got the Marion case hanging over my head and a bunch of other stuff.
You can't just drop this.
I won't. I might just ditch you at the cabin to wait for your mom. If I leave right now, I could get over to Burdette, where those Minnesota plates came from, by early afternoon. See what I can see, make it down to the cities by late tonight. Then, if nothing turns up, I might zip over to Sault Ste. Marie and sniff around. Between you and me, if this thing is outside Sault Ste. Marie, that means the city cops won't be covering it and the county cops are gonna be way overloaded. But I will not be going to Sault Ste. Marie. I've had busted ribs, and you're not going to want to walk around a lot, or even hit potholes, as you'll find out this afternoon when your mom takes you home. She's never met one that she didn't hit. So basically, you'll be hanging out with your yuppie friends, trying to decide what kind of obscenely expensive hipster high tops you'll wear back to your obscenely expensive college in the fall.
You know I'm not like that, Letty said.
You're like that a little bit, Lucas said. Like me, though not as much.
Thank Jesus. I really don't know where you get the time to shop.
It's more important to look good than to feel good, Lucas said.
What?
Never mind. Before your time, Lucas said. The statements took an hour, starting with Letty's meeting with Sky and Henry in San Francisco through the discovery of Sky's body. Lucas filled in bits about the discovery of Henry's body in South Dakota, the relationship to the probable L.A. murder of Kitty Place, about the shooting of Boney. As they were finishing, a deputy came in and said, They found an ID on that girl. Her name wasn't Sky, it was Shirley Bellows. She was from Indiana, had a couple of arrests for shoplifting and minor possession. We're trying to get in touch with her folks now, but we're having trouble locating them. Letty and Lucas looked at each other, and Letty teared up. Didn't try to hide it, and Lucas said to the deputy, Thanks for letting us know. When they got out of the sheriff's office, they walked down the street to the Angler's Bar and Grill and got cheeseburgers for breakfast. Then Letty wanted to stop at the bookstore on the corner and get newspapers to see if there'd been any coverage of the murder the night before. There had not been. Too late, Lucas said. We'll see it tomorrow. Letty went to get a magazine for the trip home, and Lucas took a minute to browse the hunting and fishing books. Somebody had left a book, facing out, about cadaver dogs. He read a few pages of it until Letty was ready to go.
Outside, she asked, "Are you going to Baudette?"
"Yeah, but I won't get there until late in the day, 4 o'clock if I leave the cabin as soon as I get you back there."
"Wish I was going," Letty said,
"but you're not. You're gonna sit on your butt until your ribs heal up," Lucas said. "Even if I gotta handcuff you to a chair."
10. Weather was unhappy that Lucas was leaving Letty at the cabin alone, but Lucas said, with a crackle of impatience,
"Listen, nobody's gonna find her at the cabin. We give highly detailed maps to friends, and they still can't find it. She'll be alone for 4 hours, watching TV. If you insist, she can go up in the attic and pull out the shotgun. But if I've got to sit here staring at her for 4 hours and then go over to Baudette, I'll have to stay overnight. I was hoping to get home tonight."
"All right, all right. We'll get there as fast as we can," Weather said. "I'll be righteously pissed if you don't make it home tonight, though."
So he left Letty at the cabin with a kiss on the forehead, with easy access to food and a Beretta 12-gauge, and headed west. He passed the Juggalo encampment, which had grown even further, still with a cluster of cop cars around the murder scene. As he went through Hayward, he got on the phone to Virgil Flowers.
"Are you still in Fergus Falls?" A moment of silence. "Where the hell else would I be?" "Hey, you don't have to be rude about it." "Fuck you, I'm hanging up."
But he didn't, not quite quickly enough. Lucas asked, "How fast can you get to Baudette?"
"Are you kidding me? I can leave in 1 minute," Flowers said. "If I have to stay here for more than another 10 minutes, I'm gonna start shooting at a state senator's cousins."
"Use your pistol. At least that way you won't actually hit anyone." Lucas and Flowers had once been in a shootout in which Flowers attempted to shoot a woman in the chest. He hit her in the foot.
"I'm laughing inside," Flowers said. "Of all the miserable, rotten, corrupt, useless political payoff assignments in the universe, I'm out spying on sheep in the middle of the night. I'm talking to a guy who says he was taken up in a flying saucer and had sexual experiments done on him, which, I gotta say, is probably the only sexual experiments he's ever had done on him that didn't involve a heifer, because he's the single least likable motherfucker in the state of Minnesota."
Yeah. You weren't really supposed to investigate, Virgil. You were supposed to pretend to investigate. You knew that. Anyway, this is serious. I'm headed over to Baudette."
He explained the situation, and Flowers asked, "Letty's really okay?"
Despite their difference in ages, there'd always been an electrical buzz between Letty and Flowers wasn't that old.
"She's fine. She hurts, but I have to say a little pain will probably be good for her," Lucas said.
"She walks up to an insane killer, literally insane, and gives him shit, and gets off with a black eye and some cracked ribs. I'll take that."
"I wouldn't if I had a daughter," Flowers said. "I'd hunt him down and shoot him with a rifle, or maybe just beat him into tomato paste."
"From what I've heard about Frankie, you probably will sooner or later have the chance to do something like that, and probably sooner. Then you'll be begging for daughter-raising advice, like the first time she comes home with her bra on backwards."
"Whatever. See you in Baudette. If I get there first, I'll check at the courthouse and find out where this guy actually lives."
"See you there," Lucas said. Lucas worried about Letty all the way through Duluth, heading west and then north in the Mercedes, until Weather called and said,
"We've got her. She's still alive. But geez, that's a black eye for the ages."
"Tell her to remember to take her stool softener," Lucas said.
With Letty safe, he worried about Flowers for a while. Flowers was one of the best investigators he'd ever met or even heard of, and had gotten himself tangled up in some strange cases. But he'd been right about the Fergus Falls assignment. The assignment had been phony from the start, and Flowers was in Fergus Falls, basically as a sop to a state senator who had some influence over a piece of the BCA budget. The fact that the senator was crazier than a bedbug and dumber than a crescent wrench hadn't changed that one salient fact. He had some influence. So Flowers had gone, and Lucas had been dragged under another inch. The drive to Bedette was fundamentally boring through low, swampy country for the most part, though the straight sections of the empty highway gave him a chance to blow the excess oil out of the Benz's cylinders. He could get it to 121, but then it started to make some strange noises, and the road was rough enough that the truck was hopping around like a grasshopper on a griddle. Lucas was closing in on Bedette when Flowers called. "I've got the address, some satellite photos, and a search warrant. Supposedly an old farm gone to seed. Where are you?" "The nav system says I'm 15 miles out," Lucas said. "What's this about a search warrant?" "The sheriff knows the place and the kid you're looking for. Says he's no good white trash and probably heavily armed. I told him the situation and he took me over to a judge's house and got us a search warrant. I didn't see any reason to say no," Virgil said. "If you're 15 miles out, you probably just passed the farm. We can either come that way, me and the sheriff's deputy with the warrant, or you can come on into town. I'm at a Holiday station. I need gas and something to eat. I'll meet you there." "Look for the giant walleye," Flowers said. Lucas eased off the accelerator as he came into town, eventually crossed a bridge, and simultaneously spotted the giant walleye, the Holiday station, and Virgil Flowers. Flowers was sitting on the hood of his 4Runner in the Holiday parking lot, wearing a tan straw cowboy hat and eating an ice cream cone. His boat was hooked to the back of the truck. Seated next to him on the hood was the deputy, also licking an ice cream cone, and the first thing that Lucas noticed about her was that she was noticeable, and she was laughing at something Flowers had said. "Fucking Flowers," he muttered to himself. Lucas parked and got out of the truck, and Flowers introduced the deputy as Nancy Mahler. Mahler hopped down and shook his hand and said, "Virgie has been telling me all about you. I'm honored." Lucas said, "Jesus, Virgil, what did you tell her?" Though he didn't mind the attention. "About how you rescued that deputy last year," she said. She had eyes the color of new-mown hay and blonde hair cut close. "He said if you hadn't kicked down the door and gone in there alone, she'd be dead now." "Well, we don't really know that," Lucas said. But he clapped Flowers on the shoulder and said, "Good to see you, guy. Let me get something to eat and we'll figure out what we're doing." Lucas got a suspicious-looking egg salad sandwich, a pack of snowballs, some strips of beef jerky, and a Diet Coke. They all got in his Benz, with Mahler peering over their shoulders from the back seat as they thumbed through the aerial photos Flowers had downloaded at the sheriff's office. "The owner's name is George Tillis, and the kid's name is Chet, or Chester," Flowers said. "Supposed to be a farm, but Tillis never farmed it. He always rented it out. Then, a few years ago, they quit farming altogether. Don't even rent it out anymore. He's been on welfare off and on, gets some medical aid, and that's about it." "Chet Tillis is a jerk, I can tell you that. We were glad to see the last of him. Likes to fight, at least when he won't lose. He's a classic bully that way. And he's been in trouble since he was a kid," Mahler said. "All crappy stuff. Got caught doing a couple of small-time burglaries. One time, 4 or 5 years back, he broke into this guy's house and stole a sack full of computer equipment and some other stuff, and the Vic's hat. The Vic had a black cowboy hat, pretty expensive for a hat. Bought it in Denver. Chet, who's got all the brains of an oyster, was wearing it around town. The Vic sees him, called us,
Chet told us he had had the hat for years, and when we took it off his head, here was the Vic's name stamped on the hat band. Hadn't even bothered to scrape it off.
So we're not talking about Einstein, Flowers said.
We're talking about a mean little jerk who, if you told him you were a cop, he'd spit on your shoe,
Mahler said.
The general feeling around the office was that sooner or later he'd kill someone, or one of us would kill him. We were just waiting for it to happen. Then one day, he picks up and leaves town. This was maybe a year ago, and we haven't seen or heard from him since.
Well, you might have your murder, Lucas said. He'd never in his life called a victim a Vic, and it made him think that Mahler might have spent too much time looking at the TV.
Virgie told me about it, Mahler said. You think he's back at the farm?
Could be, if he thinks it'd be a good place to hide, Lucas said.
What I'm really hoping is that he's still running with Pilot and his gang, and we can get a cell phone number. If we can get a number for him, we can probably figure out where he is and where the gang is.
Virgil squared up the photos, tapped the top one, and said, The farm's this fuzzy square you see here. They were fields once, but now they're getting overgrown with trash trees. You can still see the outlines. At some point, I was told that George Tillis...
He's called Pap, Mahler said.
Tried to start a cheap RV campground down there, but that went nowhere. He'll still get a camper now and then, but it's the bottom of the campground heap. He touched the map. Here's the house. It's pretty far back, a couple hundred yards, so he'll see us coming. And then way back, by this pond, there are actually two campgrounds. The back one looks like it's got four single wides. I don't know what they're about. They're not RVs.
Lucas looked at the photos and touched a wide, dark stream that showed up a few hundred yards north of the farm.
Is that the Rainy?
Yeah, it is, Mahler said.
Lucas said to Mahler, Virgil once illegally shot a guy, I think it was across the Rainy, wasn't it, Virgil? You were in Minnesota, the guy was in Canada?
Purely self-defense, Flowers said.
Gee, I'd like to hear about that, Mahler said to Flowers.
She was close enough to him, leaning over the back seat, that she could have stuck her tongue into his ear.
We better get going. I want to get back home tonight, Lucas said. He added, I suspect Frankie's probably pining for you, too, Virgie.
They went out separately, led by the deputy, Lucas behind her, Flowers trailing with his forerunner and boat. The farm was 15 minutes east of Badette.
Mahler signaled the turn well before they got to it, and they followed her bouncing down a dirt track into what looked like a forest, but was actually a fairly thin tree line that opened out into swampy-looking one-time fields, now dotted with short evergreens. Farther back, a weathered, dirty two-story farmhouse dominated the fields, with crumbling outbuildings off to the left side of the dirt patch that surrounded the house. Lucas could see that the driveway led past the house, back toward the campgrounds. They pulled into the dirt parking area, and a few seconds later, an older man stumbled out of the house. George Tillis had hair longer than Flowers's, and hadn't shaved for a week or so, the gray beard making him look even older than he was. He was wearing overalls over a stained white T-shirt and rubber boots.
What the hell's going on?
Mahler said.
Pap, we've got a search warrant for the house, looking for that boy of yours.
He's not here, and I ain't seen him. What'd he do?
He was talking to Mahler and Lucas, but his eyes kept sliding over to Flowers. Flowers was standing next to the open driver's side door of his truck, watching the confrontation across the hood. He had a shotgun lying across the front seat.
Might be involved in a murder, Mahler said. We're gonna have to take a look inside.
Well, now, I'd have to talk to my attorney about that. His eyes shifted again.
As far as I know, you don't have an attorney, Mahler said. We'll get one for you, but we get to look inside right now. So if you'll show us the way...
She stepped forward toward the house, but Tillis moved in front of her and shouted,
Is this what America has come to? The cops?
Lucas looked at Flowers and called,
He's stalling.
I'm gone, Flowers said. He grabbed the shotgun and jogged down the far side of the house and disappeared. Tillis stepped back and shouted,
What's going on? I know my rights. I want an attorney.
Mahler, you'll get an attorney, Lucas hooked her by the arm and said. Get behind my truck. Pull your firearm. I've got to cover Virgil.
What?
Just do it. Lucas pulled his gun and ran past Tillis down the near side of the house. At the back, he saw a line of people running, seven of them, strung out toward the campgrounds. Flowers had passed two of them, women wearing long dresses and headscarves, and then slowed and pointed his shotgun into the air and fired a shot.
Boom!
The 12-gauge sounded like an artillery piece, and the five runners ahead of Flowers slowed and looked back, and one cried out something that Lucas didn't understand, and they slowed and finally stopped on the dirt track. Far down the track, Lucas saw two young children and a woman run into a clump of trees. Ahead, Flowers was shouting, and the runners now had all their hands in the air. They were tall, thin people, frightened. Lucas came up, and Flowers said,
Illegals. He's running a campground for Somalis coming across from Canada. God damn it.
They got the Somalis back to the house, checked them for weapons, had them sit on the porch with Tillis, who'd gone silent, and left them with Mahler, who said more cops were on the way. Flowers got an M16 out of the back of his truck, gave it to Lucas, and the two of them walked back to the campground where they found seven more Somalis, four women and three children, hiding in the single wides. No guns anywhere. They waited until the women had packed up some clothing, then escorted them back to the house. On the way, Flowers said, They come in by ship, get dropped off on the Canadian North Shore, get trucked over here, and cross the river at night. Next day, they're in Minneapolis.
How do you know all that?
From a story in Muskie Hunter magazine, Flowers said. Then...
Just kidding. Saw it on Channel 2.
At the house, two more sheriff's cars had arrived, and the late-arriving deputies were chatting with Mahler and watching the Somalis. Mahler asked,
That all of them?
Might be some hiding out in the weeds, I don't know, Lucas said. He didn't much care, either.
I called the Border Patrol. Ought to have somebody here in 10 minutes, Mahler said.
Another sheriff's car turned in the driveway. All I want to do is look in the house, Lucas said.
Fucking Nazis,
Pap shouted at them. He and Flowers went into the house, stepping through the Somalis now clustered despondently on the porch. One of the kids was crying, and Flowers said, I kinda wish we hadn't done this. Lucas nodded.
Didn't want to.
As far as I'm concerned, they can put them in a bus and haul them down to Minneapolis and turn them loose. Not going to happen. They were now in the system.
Stinks, Flowers said as they stepped into the house.
The interior of the house was old, moldy, and poorly kept. The kitchen appeared to have been built in the 1930s and not cleaned since, smelling of bacon grease, fried eggs, and flatulence. The refrigerator was full of ready-to-microwave frozen food in the top compartment, and a dozen eggs and the remains of a pound of butter in the lower. An overflowing trash can smelled of rotten coffee grounds. Tillis had used what had once been a parlor as storage for every kind of paper. Bills, magazines, catalogs, newspapers. The rug on the parlor floor was not much thicker than a sheet, most of the nap worn through. The living room featured an oversized television, two chairs facing it, and probably 30 foxtails pinned to the crown molding, so that they hung down all around the room like fuzzy red icicles. As they walked around, pulling drawers, looking in corners, they found a half dozen guns, three rifles, three revolvers, ranging in age from old to ancient. A wired telephone sat on a side table in the living room. Lucas went there while Flowers, still with his shotgun, crept up the stairs, ready for trouble if any were up there. Lucas found a sheet of paper under the phone and the stub of a pencil off to one side. A dozen phone numbers were written on the paper. A doctor, the county, a few names that meant nothing to Lucas, and one that might have said Chet. Lucas wrote down the Chet number and started for the door when Flowers called from the second floor. "Hey, Lucas, you better come up here." Lucas turned back and climbed the stairs. Halfway up, a long strip of wallpaper had fallen from the wall and now seemed to be mostly held up by spider webs. At the top of the stairs, he found two bedrooms and a bathroom. Flowers was standing in the front bedroom, shotgun over his shoulders, next to an antique single bed with flat springs and a 2-inch-thick mattress, like an army bunk. It was covered with a dirt-gray sheet, flocked with dust bunnies. Lucas recognized the symptoms. "What have you done, Virgil?" Flowers said. "There's a roll of carpet under the bed." "What?" "A roll of carpet under the bed." Flowers was smiling, sort of, but his voice wasn't. Lucas knelt next to the end of the bed, saw a carpet roll, and in the middle of the roll, a fold of clear plastic, maybe saran wrap, now as dusty as the top sheet, but very clearly wrapped around the bones of a human foot, which were held in place by the wrapping plastic. Lucas stood up and brushed off his knees and said, "You know what? We ought to sneak out of here and let the deputies find the body," Flowers said. "Even if we could work it." "Yeah, we're too straight," Lucas said. "God damn it. All I wanted was a fucking phone number." "You get it?" Flowers asked. "Maybe. Got a check," Flowers said. "We better go tell them." Lucas let Flowers handle that while he walked to his car and got on the phone to the BCA duty officer and asked him to check the owner of the phone number he'd found. As he waited, he saw a couple of deputies, including Mahler, follow Flowers into the house. Tillis was still sitting on the steps with the Somalis. A moment later, a border patrol truck rolled into the yard, followed by another sheriff's car. The duty officer came back and said, "Goes to a Chester Tillis on Verizon." "Good. Get on to Verizon and tell them to ping it. We need to know where the phone is right now. And tell them that this is official business and the phone owner is not to be notified, however you do that. As soon as you hear back, call me." That done, he got out of his truck, met Flowers coming out the door. Flowers asked, "Now what?" "I'll call Sands and see if we can unload this on the Bemidji guys and get the hell out of here," Lucas said. Sands was the BCA director. Bemidji was the BCA's northern outpost. Flowers looked around the yard. There were now 5 or 6 deputies and a couple of border patrol guys wandering around. "Quite the little party you got going here, Lucas," Flowers said. "Reminds me of the stuff I do every day." "Thank you." A little while later, the sheriff arrived, followed by a white bus-like conversion van to transport the Somalis. Lucas and Flowers chatted with the sheriff for a few minutes, and the sheriff went up to look at the foot in the carpet roll. A few minutes later, he came back and said he suspected that it was George Tillis's mother, who hadn't been seen for a couple of decades. She supposedly had gone to California to live with her sister, but now, it appeared, might not have gotten out of the driveway.
They were still chatting when the duty officer called back and told Lucas, "He's off the grid right now, but they had him last night, first in Ironwood and then a few minutes later in Bessemer. Looks like he was heading east into the UP.
Tell them to keep pinging him. I want to know if he comes back up," Lucas said, to Flowers. "My boy is on his way to Sault Ste. Marie. I'll see you later."
"I'm not going back to Fergus Falls," Flowers called after him.
"You got anything else to do?" Lucas asked, turning back around.
Lucas, Flowers always had things to do. He covered roughly one-third of a large state.
"Then go do them. If more calls, I'll personally tell him to go fuck himself," Lucas said.
Moore was the state senator who had influence on the budget. Lucas headed home, driving fast,